fucking Soulcast. Today's guest is my homie from It's Going Down. It's Going Down is a counter-information and anarchist analysis, news, and community hub online for anarchist and anti-authoritarian struggles. Awesome website, awesome podcast. In this interview, we're just mainly going to talk about what we've seen the first year of Trump, where things are headed, kind of models of resistance and modes of resistance that we've seen that have worked, some critiques of the institutional left and the Democratic Party, and for the most part, just going to talk about a whole range of subjects to kind of get a, you know, whatever, 18-month back, looking forward about how we can be a material force, where we can intervene, and what modes of resistance have been the most inspiring and effective. So it's an awesome conversation. It's pretty long, so, you know, throw it on before you do something that will take a little long, but that's fine. So as far as my shit goes, we're about to move out to Maine, relocating, and my dog Gandhi just died, and I don't want to say I want to dedicate this podcast episode to him because he didn't listen to podcasts, but you know, I fucking love that dog, and if you listen to the podcast over the years, you've heard him in the background barking. He was super athletic, you know, running around, hiking, swimming, fetching 10-foot-long trees. Like, he just had so much character, so much, such a spunky, funny little dog. He was a Yorkie. He was my motherfucking homie. You know, we hung out every day, 14 years. Devastating to lose a friend. So, rest in power, Gandhi. You know, life is short, y'all. Be good to each other. Spread love. And fight the motherfucking power. So, forgive me for this manic, all over the place intro, but that's how life is. Now, before we get started with this awesome interview, let's hear from some comrades in the Channel Zero Podcast Network.
In this story, when you hear this, turn the page. Let's begin now.
Where did you get this?
Your friendly neighborhood anarchist.
More of an anarchist militant.
People involved in social struggles than everybody else. You know?
People have been waiting for some content.
Radio. Show.
The Final Straw, and I'm William Goodenough.
And I'm Percy Goodness.
The Final Straw Radio. Noblogs.org.
If you're listening, you are the resistance.
Oh, yeah. It's going down. Welcome to the motherfucking Soulcast.
Thanks for having me. How you doing?
I'm doing great. You know, it's I always talk about the weather, but it's fucking beautiful morning. Going to be a hot day. How about you?
It's great. It's a great time to be here, and I'm glad we're going to have this conversation. I've been looking forward to it.
Yeah, me too. Well, it's so funny because when we first started talking about this, whenever that was, it's like you just launched a fucking new podcast, and uh-huh. It's already, you're probably already halfway through episode 4 at this point, huh?
Well, we just did number 5.
Exactly.
But who's counting, you know? Right. It's every other day during the week, so we do it 3 times a week.
That's awesome. So the new podcast is like a sub podcast of It's Going Down, and it's called This Is America.
So can you talk about it and how it came to be and what you guys are doing or what y'all are doing with this new podcast?
Sure. Well, IGD is turning three this month, 3 years old. When we came out, one of the stronger parts of the site was a column that came out weekly, like religiously, called All the News You Didn't Even Know Was Going Down. People really liked it. It was useful. It kind of rounded up things that, in terms of revolt and repression, and just things that were happening within across North America that a lot of people weren't maybe paying attention to or just wasn't on the radar. And just kind of as the site has become more and more of a larger project and taken more and more time, it's been harder to put out that column. So we kind of wanted to return to some sort of presentation of news, not only of repression and, like, you know, what the forces of domination are doing in terms of the economy, ecology, police, and so on, but also in terms of resistance and autonomous struggles, and just revolt. So this is America's attempt to kind of catalog that. But also it came out of a series of discussions with our friends at Submedia about kind of what would it mean to go beyond what anarchist media is at right now. And what we've been kind of formulating and talking about is where we want to go is something that's akin to, like, what InfoWars is doing, where they have daily shows and they have, you know, especially a lot of video, multimedia stuff. You know, we're nowhere near close to that, but we feel that this radio show is potentially a step in that direction, at least in, like, formulating what it would mean to have almost daily, you know, looking at the news, looking at the headlines, being able to put out anarchist analysis of what's going on, something that could be picked up by people across the U.S. and farther in terms of radio stations and stuff like that, which is something that's already starting to happen a little bit with The Final Straw and The Hot Wire and things like that. So just kind of like seeing how far we can go with that. And so far the response has been really good. People seem to be really into it. And it's also designed to, you know, something that you could, like, turn on, like, when you're in the shower or you're driving to work or you're coming home from work. It's usually like 15 minutes long. So it's pretty easy digestible and, you know, in an amount of time that, you know, most people at least have that they can consume it and it won't take up their entire day or it won't take an hour to listen to.
Or 2 hours, like we're prone to.
That's true.
What I love about it is that, I've already told you this, but is how it just feels like it's some behind enemy lines, spy shit. So it's cool. And it's important too. I can think of times in my life when, some major event happened in the news and I was thinking about it in sort of like a anti-imperialist but liberal way. And then an anarchist would have some commentary on it that would frame it in a more like sense of like, no, this is just like the violence here and here and here. And so it is, I think, for all the people who are becoming radicalized right now, having that anti-state anarchist analysis attached to, you know, things other than our report backs is key.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to put things into context and talk about what this means. I mean, like, just the other day, I mean, the Eagles refused, most of them refused to go to the White House, and Trump put on this, this, like, military Trump rally outside the White House, and people were booing, and there was only a couple hundred people there. And it just, I mean, like, this is the time we're living in. You know, like, various sections of the elites are, like, you know, sniping at each other. You've got former directors of the CIA telling Trump that he's going to be removed to the dustbin of history. The G7 leaders in the last couple of weeks have basically told the United States, like, you're fucking crazy and, like, we want nothing to do with you. I mean, we're really at a pivotal time in the U.S. empire where the U.S. is, like, really faltering. And I think that, you know, we're going to see drastic changes in the way that our lives are going to be lived. And I think that we can look to things like what's happening in Puerto Rico as really kind of a sign of things to come. And I think that as terrifying as that is, there's also tremendous possibilities for autonomy, for people getting organized, and creating real different alternatives.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's talk about that then. So it's been 1 year and 4 months of Donald F. Trump, and you know, what you know, from your perspective, like what are some of the most inspiring things or surprising things about, you know, resistance that we've seen in the first year of Trump?
Right. Well, I think first and foremost, the thing that was important was that people, you know, took to the streets and fought back and reacted very hard and very fast. There was no waiting for, you know, the so-called left to really, like, give direction to people. And people really took to the streets and got wild. I mean, we saw massive amounts of action when Trump, you know, won the Electoral College. Remember, he did not win the popular vote. He won the Electoral College. But, I mean, people went buck wild. And in Oakland, there were riots. People were – it's interesting because people – have brought up how supposedly violent the Milo riots were a couple weeks later in Berkeley. But, you know, in Oakland, people were throwing Molotov cocktails into, you know, government buildings and stuff like that. There were student walkouts across the country. And then, you know, this happened again when Trump was actually inaugurated. We had, you know, massive amounts of anti-fascist resistance. We had everything, of course, that happened on the J20, which, you know, showed not only that there was, again, like a large amount of people on the streets that were ready to throw down, but also, and this is including, you know, the everything from the anarchist march to the blockades, but also, you know, not that many people actually showed up for Trump's inauguration. You had, you know, the massive pouring out to the airports, you know, that were largely self-organized and spontaneous. And beyond that, we saw, you know, a series of assemblies, of community discussions and conferences, people really talking about, you know, what's going to happen in the coming terrain. And I think a lot of us would, you know, pessimistically say, like, well, what happened to those? But, I mean, it was definitely a good sign that people were coming together and trying to figure it out what to do. You know, so I think all that was inspiring. And I think that kind of out of that, this is where a lot of, you know, really the role of the far right violence really came into play. You know, J20, the night ended, you know, with a IWW anti-fascist anarchist being shot in Seattle. But also just, you know, as soon as Trump came into office, we saw an escalation of, you know, racist, anti-Semitic, homophobic, misogynist attacks, which had already been growing, but, you know, were coming more and more to the open. And the response from the Trump administration was literally saying, whether it was from Trump himself or people like Gorka, saying that these were acts by the left to make the Trump administration look bad, or that they were done by the victims themselves to discredit Trump. I mean, there was a really real feeling among the far right that Trump was really giving them a green light to engage in violence. And they were, you know, they took far right white nationalist groups off of different watch lists. They removed funding from groups like Life After Hate. As Mike Pinovich would later say in a podcast before Unite the Right, that Trump and Bannon were giving them, quote, the space to destroy. And that's, you know, that's very true. And I think that far-right violence coupled with the reaction from the center that really tried to downplay and attack and parentalize every single act of working class self-expression of revolt, of getting organized and acting autonomously and attacking that, really, you know, those two forces really, you know, went together, both the far-right violence and, you know, the attacks from the center. But, and then, like, you know, by the time that you got to CPAC in early 2017, I mean, the strategy for repression was already kind of laid out. You know, you had people at CPAC, you know, openly talking about anarchists and the Black Bloc and how, you know, they were the chief enemy. You started to see the rollout of laws that were aimed at water protectors and Black Lives Matter demonstrators, you know, which we continue to see today. We continue to see that kind of ramping up of attack against all the autonomous social movements, whether they're anti-fascist, anarchists, the Black liberation struggle, the Native struggle against pipelines. I mean, all that. We continue to see that. But I mean, that began really out of the gate of the Trump administration in the face of this growing resistance. But I would say also, just in terms of what's inspiring, is just the increase of capacity that we've seen. I mean, like, it's going down since it started, has written kind of like a year in review. And if you go back to the year in review we did in 2015, we were very still much, we felt the anarchist movement, you know, broadly speaking, was in a period where we were essentially waiting for something. You know, we were waiting for the next Ferguson, you know, waiting for something to pop off. And already by the end of that year, things had started to shift because of just everything going on in the United States in terms of the election and kind of like the engine that drove certain things to happen. But I mean, we're in a very different place now. We're not waiting for things to happen. People are actively organizing. There's a lot going on, and there's a lot of different sectors that are activated, from, you know, labor to environmental struggles to Native struggles to, you know, everything happening. You know, lots of organizing around gentrification, housing, and so on. And I think that within that activation, one of the most, you know, the best things that could have happened is that people realize that the left itself, you know, the official left in terms of political parties and official union leadership, nonprofits, was something that they had to come up against and struggle against to move beyond. And I think probably one of the best examples of that, you know, we've seen recently is the wildcat strikes that have taken place, you know, starting in West Virginia and moving onward. People realizing that union leadership tied hand in glove with the Democratic Party was something that they basically had to, you know, knock down and move beyond. And I mean, that's a huge, you know, huge part of understanding, like, how things are going to change in the United States. But I think just kind of some other projects we'll shout out, the Burgerville Workers Union in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, inspiring just in the organizing that they did, the amount of stores that they were able to spread into, you know, beyond the fact that they've become the first officially recognized fast food union in the United States. You know, we saw a bunch of rent strikes and tenant assemblies forming across the U.S. and Canada. We're seeing like the explosion of pipeline battles. We're seeing like the forming of the Hellbender Autonomous Zone. I think that the J20 support and defense have been inspiring. It's gone on for a year and a half. I think a lot of people just would have like given up and dropped out. People are still going. You know, you, like we mentioned before, you know, this explosion of wildcat strikes, everything that's gone into the anti-fascist struggle this year. I think we're seeing an explosion of really awesome media projects that just continue to grow and grow. Every week there seems to be a new podcast, a new website, a new video project, and also just continued prisoner movement. I mean, the start of this year was kicked off by, you know, prison uprisings, and, you know, we continue to see that. Started the Trump administration 2017 in Vaughan. You know, we saw a prison uprising that was in part a rejection of the Trump presidency, and we're continuing to see that to this day. And, you know, currently people are getting ready for another big prison strike in August of 2018, in a couple months.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy to me to see words like abolition just thrown around a lot more now, and like all these projects where, like, even like, you know, middle of the road projects, like, that are just doing bail fund, just creating bail funds in cities. Like, they're mm-hmm. a lot of them are like, you know, bail fund and jails, you know? And so shit's, yeah, that it's seems like the prisoner stuff especially is, people are really starting to realize, like, wow, this is super fucked up what we've done here.
Right. And I think, like, you know, bringing up like the abolitionist perspective is definitely something that anarchists, and, you know, I'm going to use the term anarchist, but what I really mean is a broad, you know, anti-authoritarians, communalists, abolistas, anti-state communists. I mean, everybody that's kind of not for state power, does not want a vanguard party, wants, you know, grassroots, you know, from the ground up change and also a movement. So I'm going to use that term, but I mean it in a very broad sense. But yeah, I think that, you know, the growing kind of like push for abolition, not only of prisons, but also of ICE, the police. I mean, that is definitely a gift to us, and that we should, you know, engage in working with people that are working towards that goal. I mean, like, I'm going to mention this several times in this podcast, but right now there's a Chingalo Emigra tour that's happening across the U.S. that's calling for the abolition of ICE. I mean, it's something that we should very much be involved in, even if the people that are organizing it may or may not consider themselves anti-authoritarian or anarchist.
So from the perspective of many, like, anti-fascism was like the most visible anarchist street movement happening, or anarchistic street movement happening. And, you know, it seems like I'm always just shocked when I'm out places, or like I'm getting general feedback from people, and, you know, they're like, why not just let them speak? You know, why do people have to resort to violence? And it's pretty much been proven that through these struggles by people militantly resisting, like, they successfully made it impossible for people like Spencer or white supremacists to gather space in public. But, like, why do you think it is that people are still arguing about free speech and punching Nazis? It just blows my mind.
Well, I mean, I think a lot of that comes from people's own cowardice and their own inability to confront anything. So therefore, they feel that they have to defend their own inaction. So, I mean, if a bunch of people are saying, like, you know, we should defend our community, and another person is like, well, I don't want to do that because I'm afraid. I mean, obviously, they're going to, like, create a narrative and an ideology around their own sense of inaction. And I think this is where a lot of journalists come into play, is because they feel that out of their role of journalist, of, like, being this, like, super smart, you know, sassy person that's going to, like, ask the right questions and expose these people for who they are. And I don't want to take away from the very real work that a lot of journalists are doing right now to actually expose neo-Nazis. I think that's great. I mean, there's a lot of journalists right now that are actually doing it really right. But, if you wind the clock back to 2016, before Trump came into power, and just kind of like this like mad rush to cover the alt-right, people were just going into – a lot of journalists were just going into such detail and explaining the movement and explaining what everything meant, and just, you know, doing really the work for the alt-right on a mass scale. You know, a lot of that came from, you know, the idea that people just thought that they were going to, like, make fun of it and it would go away. And, you know, obviously that's just not how things work, you know. Like, it's not. And I think – but still, people create, like, this ideology – around, like, their own inability to confront things or their own desire to defend anything. And I think that's where a lot of that comes from. And also just, you know, the, you know, centrism, you know, and liberalism are political positions that unfortunately some people hold. And they believe that the state should be the arbiter of any sort of, you know, tension within society. And, you know, I think that that's why ultimately, anti-fascism was really important, you know, since Trump came into office, was because, you know, from the standpoint of, like, centrists at, like, the Southern Poverty Law Center, you know, their whole reason for existing is to tell people how bad the far right is. But ultimately, what they want to do out of that is they want to get the state to do something about it. Now, if there's any time in history that you could argue that, like, that is not a winning strategy because of who's in office and the fact that there are key connections between, you know, the far right. I mean, right now, Trump is, if he hasn't already, he's getting ready to pardon Dinesh D'Souza, you know, the you know, somebody that has made their career on arguing that the Nazis were left wing to make conservatives not feel so bad for rubbing elbows with the alt-right. You know, he's talking about letting, you know, the Bundy people off the hook as far as charges. You know,
Trump is? Was,
yeah. I mean, something that Roger Stone has lobbied Trump to do. I mean, Roger Stone himself, I mean, you know, a key Trump ally, you know, uses the Proud Boys as, you know, personal bodyguards at events. I mean, there's so many connections. I mean, his sons follow alt-right accounts. I mean, Trump has retweeted literal neo-Nazi groups in the UK. I mean, you could just go on and on and on. I mean, there's just so many, you know, red flares. And there's so many reasons to point out and say, like, look, the state isn't going to do shit about the growth of a far-right movement that, you know, sees itself basically working hand in glove, you know, with the administration as it pushes forward its own agenda. So therefore, there must be another force which arises to protect, you know, human communities from the growth of the far right. And I think that, you know, that's a message that resonates with a lot of people. And I think that that's why people got so freaked out about, you know, this growth of, you know, this combative, largely youthful, largely working class. You know, it wasn't based in universities. It was, you know, it was very street based. It was very grassroots, you know, bringing together, you know, broad multi-section of anarchists, you know, a lot of, you know, young people that were in DSA that got excited about Bernie. And now all of a sudden they're putting on a balaclava and trying to punch Richard Spencer. So, I mean, you know, these are all things that, you know, freaked the establishment out. And that's why Antifa has become, you know, in many ways it's unfortunate, but it's become, you know, the new communist, you know, it's like a slur now. And, you know, the far right is running around trying to throw it onto everything. I mean, we've written about this on It's Going Down, but I think one of the most hilarious things is, like, you know, in the pipeline fights, the far right in some areas is trying to term, you know, water protectors as green Antifa. Because, I mean, they don't, you know, they have, like, limited amount of terms that the people on their side understand, but they know Antifa. So if they can call them green Antifa, then they can somehow, like, you know, win. But...
Oh, my God. Yeah, well, one thing I wanted to kind of respond to and back up is the stuff you were saying about how people defend their own inaction. I was recently at a family event and talking about this with a cousin who's a teacher, and she was saying, you know, I brought, like, after Charlottesville, I marched in Boston with 10,000 other people, and I brought my students there, and it was powerful, and it was peaceful. And I was like, and you know, and she's like, you know, to me, they both resemble Antifa, and the far left and the far right really resemble each other to me. And I'm like, the far left isn't out there killing people, you know?
I would say in Boston, it wasn't peaceful. There was fights, there was arrests, there were clashes with the police. So, I mean, this idea that it was somehow peaceful is a complete misnomer. Also, the police in Boston, you know, we're talking about, there was an alt-right rally like literally a week after Charlottesville. The police had to basically put those people in a van and get them out of the area so the crowd didn't kill them. I mean, so this idea that somehow violence was somehow removed from the situation is just not true. But also, I mean, the degree in which violence was de-escalated, like no one died, there was nobody injured, you know, maybe in a critical way, I mean, was because there was so many people there. And I mean, I think that was the message that the anti-fascist movement sent to the broader population, was like, look, like, we don't have to have a street fight. If enough people come out and shut these people down, we can win. But again, you know, the people that were putting that work in were largely anarchists, you know, largely anti-fascists that were building coalitions with people, encouraging people to come out. I mean, that was hard work, you know, and it took Charlottesville to kind of generalize that, but it shouldn't have, because there were lots more Heather Heyers that were killed by people in the alt-right. I mean, James Harris Jackson in March of 2017, you know, a Daily Stormer fan, guy that listened to Richard Spencer's podcast, literally traveled from Baltimore to New York with a sword and found a 66-year-old African-American man and put a sword through him and murdered him on the street. And, you know, that should have been the wake-up call this country needed to what was happening. And it wasn't. And there were more people after him that died. And there continue to be more and more. I mean, how many people associated with the alt-right have carried out acts of mass murder? I mean, look at the guy in Parkland. Literally wore a MAGA hat, you know, at various times, was photographed with the Trump hat, you know, etched swastikas into his gun that he used to murder these people, these students in Florida. I mean, no one has even asked Donald Trump about the fact that people continue to become mass murderers and wear his hat as an icon. I mean, if that's not a symbolism of a spectacular society that doesn't even want to recognize itself for what it is, I mean, I don't know what. But I mean, that's just really crazy to me.
Yeah, it's definitely crazy to hear it that way. It never occurred to me, like, why hasn't anyone ever asked Trump that? Well, just to end the cousin thing, basically what she was saying was that she was uncomfortable punching a Nazi. And I was like, but you don't have to. Like, you know, like, what? Just don't. Yeah. Don't. No one's asking you to. You know, like, I don't go around, I'm not punching a Nazi. You know, like, just show up anyway.
And then, I mean, that's the shift from somebody that sees themselves as an atomized individual that maybe at times will feel the need to, like, because of some, like, virality on social media, they're going to go off and they're going to join the women's march and they're going to take their 5 selfies and they're going to go home and they're going to feel like, you know, just like your cousin did, that they did something and they took their students and, like, they did their good deed as a citizen that day and so on and so forth. And they can kind of cleanse their hands of the situation from then on to something that feels like they're part of a social movement, you know, somebody that's like, maybe I per se will not be the one that punches the Nazis, but I will definitely not, for one, talk shit about them. I will defend them. And also, you know, the biggest thing is I'm not going to give them up to the police. You know, I'm not going to, like, endanger the people that do take those risks. And I think that's the pivot. That's the pivot, you know, that we need in all of these, you know, social movements and social struggles, is away from, you know, these spectacular atomized individuals that are just feeding off these things through social media to somebody that feels part of it, you know, even if they're taking a passive supporting role. And I think that that's, again, like, just to come back to anti-fascism, you know, that's why, for instance, the police were so freaked out in Berkeley, was because that there was a coalition that formed that included anarchists, included anti-fascists as a defensive force against the alt-right. This is right after Charlottesville in late August. And the police were freaked out. You know, they were angry and upset that the rest of the left was allowing anarchists and the Black Bloc to be, you know, something that was part of a larger movement, you know, and that's when they started talking about criminalizing them as a gang and all that other stuff. But, you know, again, that's that kind of shift that we want.
Right. Well, so some of the other things I wanted to talk about was what's happened with environmental pipeline struggles in the United States after Standing Rock. Like, Standing Rock is, you know, probably the most inspiring shit I've seen, and yeah, so I'm just kind of curious, is like, where do you see things are at now with environmental struggles and various pipeline things happening across North America?
Well, I think what's interesting is that, you know, in the past several months, past year, you know, I think weighing on the minds of a lot of our comrades has been the ZOD and how important it is that the ZOD be defended. The ZOD is an occupied section of France that for the past 5 decades, people have been fighting against the construction of an airport. In the last 8 years or so, anarchists, autonomous ecological, environmental activists and stuff like that have come to the area and squatted it and kind of like built this kind of communal, there's no government, city, kind of like in the middle of this, idyllic swampland. And I think that
one thing I would just add to that is with the support of local farmers,
Sure. And I think that the question that we would raise is that why isn't this happening on the same level of all the pipeline battles that we're seeing? Because there's a lot of similarities. And in fact, actually what's happening in Virginia and West Virginia, from what I've listened to on podcasts and the sense that I've got is that, the kind of the inspiration from the ZAD that they had was to start to view themselves as what they call the Hellbender Autonomous Zone, which is basically the area that's in contestation with the pipeline companies that's sort of in this couple mile radius of Virginia and West Virginia in a series of mountains where people are actively fighting the construction of the pipelines. But I think as a movement, we need to move towards finding ways to support these land struggles, whether they're like things like in Northern California, there's a couple decades long fight to save the Mattole Forest, or, what's happening in Louisiana fighting the Bayou Bridge Pipeline, or in the Virginias with the fight against the Atlantic Coast Pipeline and the Mountain Valley Pipeline. But I mean, there's so many different pipeline fights that are happening across the U.S. and Canada, and of course across the world. But I think we as a movement need to kind of sit down and strategize more about what would it mean to, if we physically can't be there, how can we support these struggles? How can we make them more and more into autonomous zones where we're not only physically fighting this infrastructure of industrial civilization, but we're creating new forms of life, and we're creating, zones to defend. And I think that's what's really inspiring in the Virginias is that, like if you go back and listen to the podcast that we've done that are there, it's inspiring in a lot of ways. The first way it's inspiring is because the teacher strike has happened and there's this energy that's in the air, in this very rural, supposedly conservative state that also has this insurrectionary history of, like the Battle of Blair Mountain, miners taking up arms in multiracial groups against the state, and the state actually responding to, these insurrections with, massive amounts of force. The Battle of Blair Mountain in 1921 was the only time the U.S. Air Force has actually been used against, everyday people. But, these, militant struggles, like, again, coming back and offering kind of like, inspiration to current ones. I mean, that's why during the teacher strike that just broke out, people were wearing red bandanas to, remember and kind of like honor that insurrectionary history of the mine wars in the 1920s. But, the teacher strike again, like, kind of opened up the space where a lot of people were like, in favor more so of all the pipeline battles, which is really inspiring, but also just, people coming together across all these different lines. I mean, people that are, whose homes are going to be eminent domain, coming out and, sitting in trees, just everyday people in the Virginias, in Appalachia, working with, genderqueer anarchists, in trees, it's just like, it's really inspiring. And I think that we need that across the country. And that's something that we need to kind of push for. But for sure, to answer your question, I mean, there's been a huge explosion since Standing Rock. I mean, people that had that experience went back to their locations and put those tactics, to work. I think that what we need to do, though, is to build up as much capacity as possible to support these struggles, because in a lot of ways, there's just not enough people on the ground. There needs to be more people, not only supporting and raising money and sending supplies, but also people on the front lines.
Well, it's funny. I always love talking about permaculture, but in my permaculture course, one of the places that we were holding workshops at was a spot, Woodbine, which is like this incredible, mm-hmm. Incredible place where conferences and stuff happen. And they were using that space as like a central hub to gather resources to send out to Standing Rock, because Standing Rock was only whatever, six to eight hours from here. And so one of the things that they had proposed that we were trying to do with the permaculture course was like try to was Woodbine's idea was to try to invent and come up with new ways of thriving in the winter, and like new methods of strengthening occupations as far as like logistic stuff. And we never got to do that, but like that's an example of the sort of challenge people can think of, like show up with solar panels, know how to use solar, like think outside the box a little bit.
You know, one story I'll tell that's always stayed with me, and this is, you know, decades old, but in Eugene, Oregon, you know, there's a history of tree sitting, you know, outside the city to stop the logging of old growth trees. And at one point, you know, people were tree sitting, and, you know, when you're up in a tree, you go to the bathroom in a bucket, and, you know, that goes down to the floor in buckets, and people were taking that and using it as compost. And then they would, you know, at a certain point when the poop had turned into compost, they would send that back to the city, and people in the city and different community gardens would take the compost and use it to grow vegetables, which they would in turn send back up to the tree sitters. And I think that kind of, you know, ecosystem of support and struggle, I mean, we need to push for that. I feel like that's what you're talking about. But I mean, there's no reason that people, you know, within 4 or 8 hours from all of these sites of contestation, even if you can't be on the front lines, I mean, we should all be figuring out what nodes of support, sending money, sending supplies, all that stuff.
Sending shit. So since Trump, what are some of the most successful modes of radical resistance you've seen this year that you think should be replicated? And I think Burgerville and the rent strikes are like good examples of that. But if in the pipeline stuff, but if there's anything else that stands out to you.
Yeah. And like, you know, we kind of mentioned some of those things. So what I would say in kind of lieu of that is I think that what's been really inspiring is, you know, when we can bind all of our strengths together, which is us, you know, organizing to win, it's building capacity, building support from, you know, a base of communities, using the infrastructure that we have, you know, like in all of these various days of action and support for the J20, you know, on the last J20, it's going down in CrimeThink had a call for kind of like a reflection for the coming year. People organized block parties. They organized conferences. I mean, there was just so much that took place in terms of people doing events, you know, even in small towns, just people like showing trouble and having a discussion with, you know, 10 of their friends. You know, it's fantastic. But, you know, really using the infrastructure that we have as a movement, which, you know, may seem small based on wherever you're at, when you kind of step back and you realize that there's a huge, vast network of anarchist info shops, community centers, and bookstores across, you know, not only the country, but the world. I mean, it's pretty impressive. And also, like, feeding off of virality and spontaneity in the networks we have, but also not depending on it. I feel like a lot of times we kind of, like, just throw something on the internet and expect, you know, somebody's going to do something. I mean, and a lot of times, you know, people do, but we need to kind of like use spontaneity and the networks we have, but also we need to like be organized enough to make stuff happen too. So we kind of need the best of both worlds. You know, I think some examples of that would be like what happened during the prison strike of 2016, where there was just a massive outpouring of action, you know, almost by and large, mainly from the anarchist movement, you know, which is a huge amount of work and organizing and solidarity events and actions that took place across, you know, probably about 2 months of time.
Would you mainly credit the IWOC, the international, the incarcerated workers movement, for that?
Or, well, I mean, first and foremost, the people that set the prison strike in motion were, you know, formations inside the prison. But in terms of, you know, organizing like boots on the ground to engage in action. IWOC was a huge part of it. I mean, there was also networks like the Anarchist Black Cross. There were just, you know, people that had been doing prison distros for years and years and years. I mean, it was a mix. It was not just IWOC, but IWOC was also a large part of it. You know, just like in 2018, it will be the same thing. So, and again, it's like also finding the ability to put all those pieces into place. I mean, not everybody's in IWOC, not everybody's in the Anarchist Black Cross, but how do you get everybody on the same page and able to, you know, move and accomplish something?
Yeah.
I mean, that at times is very hard. I mean, like the movement we have now is like a mix of everybody from, you know, green ski mask, you know, Bookchinite people in Portland and Demand Utopia to Apolista folks in, you know, Woodbine to Insurrectionary Anarchists to, you know, people in the IWW. I mean, it's a huge, vast swath of people that, you know, don't all get along and at times have very different ideas about the kind of movement that they think will change the world. But, you know, we're the most powerful when we're able to, you know, at least put in the work together and, you know, put some shit aside and, you know, not only work together, but at least all, you know, put in and put in that work.
Yeah, for sure. Shout out to Demand Utopia, for sure. I got to meet a bunch of them in the Pacific Northwest, and they were, you know, I don't know. I just like people who are unpretentious, like just more unpretentious people who are having fun and fighting. It's great.
And just a couple more shout outs. You know, just the growth of, you know, tenant organizing. You know, the mass anti-fascist actions we've seen over the past couple of years have been really inspiring. And also, you know, the disaster relief work. I mean, who would have thought, you know, 2 years ago, 3 years ago that, you know, we would be watching people in Puerto Rico put in a solar array at a squatted house or squatted school, you know, and people organizing community center around it. You know, I mean, it's inspiring stuff. I mean, look at what, you know, Mutual Aid Disaster Relief was able to do in Florida, you know, work out of a church to have, you know, a clinic, a free clinic. You know, this is the type of stuff that's going to really take us into the next level. You know, this is the stuff that we need to happen in every single city. I mean, imagine where we would be at if we had not only, you know, info shops and community centers, but free clinics and, you know, really bringing back those survival programs from the Panthers. And, you know, putting it, you know, into the hands of our movement. I mean, that would be a game changer. And again, these are things to think about that, you know, these are the things that seem impossible now, but these are the directions in which we need to go that will really take us on to the next level.
Yeah, I mean, in Oaxaca, they have their own cell phone network. You know, I would also just tack on to what you were saying. You know, as you were talking about the hurricane disaster relief support stuff. You know, like when I've talked to people who are engaged in that stuff, I'm like, oh, what have you been doing this week? Just fucking gutting houses. I'm fucking exhausted. I've just been fucking scraping wallpaper off and getting mold out of people's houses. And it's like, that's some of the most, you know, important work you can do, you know? And then like half of the time you're just spent like crying with someone as they put all their belongings out on the curb too, you know? And like that stuff isn't sexy. But it's like, that's the really important, you know, components of all this stuff.
And that's something that you can actually take a large group of people and give them something to do. I mean, I think that's the other thing, and we'll talk about this later. But I mean, you know, one of the big things that we need right now is, you know, stuff for a lot of new people to do.
Right. For sure. Let's see. Okay. Yeah, what let's talk about student struggles a little bit. You know, you have groups like TPUSA that are like trying to take over college campus that are fucking causing a lot of problems for people. And that are kind of like, you know, the alt-light brown shirts of the college campuses. It's actually, I mean, it seems like that the movement of like right-wing organizing on campuses it took me by surprise. I wasn't ready for it to happen as quickly as it did.
Right.
And there have been like a lot of like, I've seen a lot of interesting student groups popping up. So I guess in your opinion, what have been successful radical interventions within student struggles, and any thoughts on the student shit that's going on?
Well, first and foremost, I would say that, you know, it'd be best to have somebody on from those networks. I mean, definitely shout out to, you know, the people in Austin, Texas with the, you know, the network of autonomous students there, an anarchist group. That's actually not their name, I don't think, but it's something like that. Autonomous Student Network, that's it. Also, like, there's a new project, Cutting Class, that's kind of bringing different people together. There's people in Pittsburgh, there's the Uncontrollables in North Carolina. There's a lot of different anarchist student groups that have popped up. I know that during kind of like the March for Our Lives thing, I was actually very surprised that people were able to kind of like put forward a very anarchist position that was neither for gun control, but neither like against students like self-organizing and taking action. You know, people went out and handed out flyers, you know, as you know, as an easy thing to do. So I think that there's a lot going on in terms of student stuff, and definitely we need to support that. And hopefully those groups will continue to be in conversation with each other. I think in terms of Turning Point USA, I mean, the thing about them is they have, you know, institutional support. I mean, like Charlie Kirk, the leader of Turning Point USA, is like, you know, he interviews the president. He speaks at CPAC. His father, you know, from my understanding, works for Trump in some capacity. In fact, I think Turning Point USA has an office in Trump Tower. So, I mean, you know, they're part of the regime, you know, in many ways. You know, this idea that they are somehow like this countercultural, you know, phenomena that like thumbs its nose at the establishment is just, you know, complete and utter bullshit. You know, they're, you know, it's a bourgeois movement. You know, it supports the ruling structure, you know, although a certain segment of it. But also it definitely feeds off of this alt-right energy. I mean, there's pictures of Charlie Kirk doing the stupid little okay hand symbol. I mean, he knows what he's doing. I mean, they're signaling to the wider alt-right that, you know, basically we're on your side. You can kind of come to us, you know, although they kind of like take this, you know, we don't believe in any identity politics, including white identity politics. And, you know, we're just libertarians. I mean, there's still a space, you know, for the alt-right and the alt-light within these, you know, more institutional and, you know, bourgeois, you know, formations like Turning Point. And also, you know, they get tons of money from foundations like youth, you know, the youth. There's various different formations like Youth for Liberty, or I can't even think of them now, but things that are like funded by the Koch brothers and stuff that get massive amounts of money to bring out conservative speakers, which includes people like Milo, includes people like Ann Coulter, which have had, you know, associations and connections to white nationalist groups and basically mainstream a lot of alt-right ideas. So, I mean, in that way, I mean, you know, there's no way to compete with them that way. I mean, a section of the ruling class isn't going to be like, you know what, anarchism is a fine idea and we'll support it. You know, it's just, it's not going to happen. So we're never going to be able to kind of beat them on that level. So we're going to have to out-organize them. And I think that also just the what they've tapped into is, you know, a wide dissatisfaction with, you know, neoliberalism, both economically and kind of like as a culture. And the fact that kind of this multicultural, politically correct kind of society where everyone is supposedly represented, even though, you know, we for sure don't live in a post-racial society. I mean, the wealth gap between whites and African Americans and families of color is wider than ever. I mean, there's still, you know, huge problems of structural racism and white supremacy. I mean, you know, we could go on and on, you know, mass incarceration, police killings, you know, housing, so on and so forth, environmental racism. I mean, all these things are real. But I mean, they've tapped into just, you know, this, you know, rejection of, you know, neoliberal, politically correct, you know, language and so on and so forth. And they've, you know, managed to kind of run with it. And I think, you know, responding to that means responding to the crisis of capital in the state and really speaking to what, you know, what is the crisis of our time? You know, what are the main problems? Is it the fact that women on campus want a safe space and they don't want to be sexually assaulted? Or is it the fact that, you know, we have mass pandemics of, rape culture within, you know, campuses to begin with?
I mean, the good news about what you're saying about funding is that Elon Musk actually says direct democracy would be desirable. So maybe Comrade Elon will come through. But, you know, as far as like the funding thing goes, the only thing I wanted to add to that is like what I find really frustrating is that people actually really truly believe that George Soros funds all this shit. And, you know, when, and it offends me because I just, I've been there with people scraping together tip money to buy materials to go to fucking Goodwill and buy banners, you know, and make banners and shit. And like,
well, I mean, I think just, people say that because there's enough people that say it and they feel like they can get away with saying it, and that enough people, if they say George Soros, they'll nod their heads yes, you know, because it's just a lie that's been said so many times that, you know, you can get away with saying it and you don't need to explain yourself. I mean, that's the kind of society that we live in now, is that people can just like say some buzzwords and people will nod their heads and like sort of agree, even though they have no idea what they're talking about. But I mean, the thing is that, you know, we still live in a really fucked up racist class society, and that people can actually feel those problems. I mean, people know what it's like to get evicted. They know what it's like to like turn on the tap water and see it be fucking brown. I mean, you can't get around that. You know, you can't like put some stupid rich kid like right wing ideology on that. It's fucked up. And like, you know, people have a, you know, people need to ask themselves if that's the kind of world they want to live in. But a lot of those people are going to be on a college campus and be around Turning Point USA to begin with. But I think that, you know, that's, you know, that's part of the anarchist project, is returning like, you know, the discourse back to like everyday experiences, what people are living through. And also just like, you know, cementing our own, you know, class, you know, interests like into the conversation. You know, it's not just like some pie in the sky, you know, socialism or communism, man. It's like, no, fuck you. Like, we don't give a fuck about rich people. Seriously, like, we don't give a fuck. Like, we don't give a fuck about their class interests, what they have to say. Fuck you. Like, we're here for ourselves. We're here to make our communities better. We're here to make a better world for our kids. We're here to actually have a living environment that's going to, you know, be here for the next, like, 100 years. Like, fuck everything else. So, you know, people need to get back down to that level.
Yeah, totally. And you know, away from cruelty, because I feel like that's a motive. Like, when I've come up against TPUSA people, I just found them to be like, you know, there's a little sadistic. There's some sadistic shit that also is, yeah, one of the big things about Trump.
They're also terrified. I mean, this is like the dual thing where they want to be like these really mean people, but then as soon as anything happens or anybody points a camera at them or calls them out, then they're total victims. I mean, you can't be both, you know? You can't be a supreme being here to represent the traditional values of Western culture, which is the best, and blah, 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 and then be a total victim. And like, which is it? Or, you know, are you the Ubermensch, or are you a total failure in your mom's basement that, like, can't do anything and you're about to kill yourself because, you know, you're such a failure? You know, it's like, which one is it? You know? And so, and I think a lot of these people are just so, I mean, they're so alienated. I mean, look at like Jordan Peterson, you know, the demigod for far right ideology is literally saying, like, in order to stop the rise in incel, like, alt right violence, we need to bring back mandatory monogamy and force women to marry men so they'll be fulfilled and they won't, you know, basically they'll be sex slaves and that men will be able to have sex and
so they'll stop, you know, shooting up schools.
It's like literally, like, that. That's where we're at. Like the ruling, like, this is like what counts as discourse in America. Like the idea of, like, giving somebody health care or, you know, making sure that they have an environment that's, like, stable and that, you know, their kids are going to be okay. Like, no, we can't talk about that. But what we can talk about, instead of some, like, quasi, like, semi-socialist New Deal, is instead, like, restructuring society to the point of having sex slaves and, like, an insane patriarchal system that, like, you know, puts women as, you know, subjugated individuals. I mean, that in itself is, like, I think very telling about where we're at in society, and also, like, should be a very huge warning sign. Just like, you know, Donald Trump calling, you know, migrant workers animals, you know? I mean, this is where they're pointing to. Is a complete restructuring to save this collapsing system, to save this civilization. And it's not about, you know, having things more fair or taking just a tiny amount of the wealth they're skimming from the rest of us and, like, making sure that we have some sort of a safety net. No, they don't want anything about that. What they want is, like, a new version of slavery. And I mean, again, like, this is what this system has to offer. This is what's on display. Or there's a complete, you know, blinders. I mean, you know, I don't, like, Trump, you know, just completely denying that climate change is a factor. I mean, like, literally no other country believes that. Like, you have scientists saying the same thing that, you know, the Unabomber was saying 20 years ago. I mean, like, if you look at the established circles of the elites, NASA, the CIA, I mean, they all say the same thing, that things are going to get worse, that human society is going to be more compacted into large cities, that climate change and wealth disparity are going to cause more and more problems. I mean, and again, like, if you look at the stuff that they're saying, so I don't necessarily disagree with it, except what we're saying is that there needs to be a complete restructuring of society to get out of this mess. And what they would say is that there just needs to be more and more repressive forces to keep civilization, to keep society from collapsing in on itself, which is, you know, the role of government to begin with. But I mean, you know, they don't have a solution for the crisis that's here. You know, there's literally no solution.
I know. It's insane. It's insane. And then when you add the... you know, automation and just fucking right. Gig economy. It's,
I mean, there's so many things on the horizon that are very scary. I mean, like, you know, there's a lot of reports and kind of projections that, you know, in 10 to 15 years, 40% of the jobs that exist right now will be either negatively impacted or replaced by automation. In 10 to 15 years, there's some projections that say 50% of the workforce will be what is called freelance, which means, you know, in the gig economy, which in many ways is, I mean, if you really stop and think about that. So if you're like a millennial now, if you're like 30, in like 10 or 15 years, you're going to be like 45. Imagine half of the population, you know, working in the gig economy, like searching on apps for jobs, looking through Craigslist, driving for Lyft or Uber. I mean, not only, like, what type of society creates that, but just, like, what life would look like. I mean, it's you know, it's really bad. But also, like, when you factor into the U.S. Becoming more and more either this kind of, like, techno dystopia where, like, cities are completely gentrified and controlled, totally policed, and everyone's priced out except for, like, a yuppie core. And the rest of us are kind of pushed to the suburbs or just out in the middle of nowhere.
Or the only way we can afford to, to stay is if we live in a trailer in our backyard and rent out our house to some fucking tech asshole. I mean, that's the shit that blows my mind, is like the calculations that are made about time and money and like, you know, like you eventually get to a point where someone can look at something you want and be like, I want that. You know, I want to rent that guy's house. You know, I want to fucking, it's crazy. I want you to come over and weed my garden. Are you on the weed app? Are you on the garden app? You know?
And again, like, to go back to kind of like the ideology that's up for grabs is like, I mean, like, you know, that's kind of, that is the dream of the, you know, the Bitcoin, crypto, you know, quote, anarcho-capitalist libertarian types is to have a society like that where every road is privatized. And if you drive down my road, you've got to give me $5. And, you know, it's horrible. You know, it's completely disgusting. And I think that that's what makes, you know, the anarchist alternative and autonomy, you know, so much more enticing when you look at the kinds of things that people are building, whether it's, you know, in Puerto Rico or, you know, in Rojava or Chiapas or what have you. I mean, it's, you know, give me that instead.
Yeah. And, you know, I think, like, you know, post scarcity anarchism in a lot of ways can fulfill a lot of like those tech fantasy promises, but try to do so in a more holistic and equitable way. Well, at least according to the science fiction novels I've read based around post-scarcity anarchism, which were pretty inspiring. But shout out the Culture series. Have you ever read that?
Have not.
Yeah, might like it. Might not, though. It's kind of like Die Hard. It's like, you know, it's like trashy a little bit, but it's cool. Well, what about, so now, you know, Trump's building his wall, rounding up migrants, you know, every day we hear some new story, whether it's like, you know, right. people being detained, delivering pizzas, families being separated. I was thinking about that piece, The Death of the Borderlands, and how, like, the work that No More Deaths has been doing is coming under attack, and they're looking at some interesting stuff. I'd love to have someone from that on at some point. But, and, you know, we're seeing ice trucks being blocked. And so I guess I'm just wondering where you see the quote unquote anarchist role in the immigration issue, because it seems like it's not something I've seen a ton of quote unquote anarchist activity from, I guess.
Yeah, and I think it would be good to kind of have like a real clear, you know, investigation of what it would mean to act in solidarity. I mean, I think there's been a lot that people have done. I think that it needs to be fleshed out more, especially for new people or people that, you know, are not inundated in that struggle. But I think there's a lot of things that people can do and how they can approach it. I think that at this point, like anything that people can do to give people resources to help struggles that are already happening and to fight back is definitely needed. I think, you know, first and foremost, I think originally a lot of anarchists kind of like downplay this idea, but studies have shown that the more people know their rights in terms of, you know, what immigration forces can do and don't do, and just in terms of stops, the harder it is for ICE to come down in certain neighborhoods. So doing things like just having know your rights trainings, you know, going to a flea market or a place where a lot of people are at and passing out know your rights information in terms of ICE and just having those conversations. I think that's like a minimum easy thing that people can do, you know, putting up those posters, all that stuff. I think the other thing that has in many ways superseded anything anarchists have done. Although I do want to say, like, I know you're going to be talking to people with Black Rose. I think the stuff that Black Rose in LA has done has been completely phenomenal. They've been able to basically build essentially like a solidarity network, a rapid response team around ICE. And they've actually been able to stop ICE from coming in certain times and even chase them out. And if, you know, if we had something like that in every city, of course, you know, I think the game would be a lot different. But I think that talking to them is great about, you know, what they have. I think, you know, obviously in Los Angeles, they have a huge base to pull from, but they've put a lot of work into that project. So I think that, you know, definitely supporting rapid response projects, if there is one in your city, or if you are able to put that massive amount of work in to do that, I think that's obviously another route. I know there's even a lot of nonprofits that have, like, you know, text alert systems and things like that. The other thing is that there's a lot of churches that have essentially underground railroads that are taking people that are fleeing from ICE or fleeing deportation, and they're staying in churches and either, you know, in terms of sanctuary, like the ICE knows where they're at and they're just like in a church. I know in Denver there was a couple cases where there were people that stayed in the church for a period of years, I think, to avoid deportation, or they're like staying in churches and like moving across territory in order to like get away. And I think finding out what churches are doing that in your area and just, you know, finding if there's anything you can do, like, can we help? Like, can we get on a text alert so we know when to show up to bring food or to help out and so on and so forth. But I mean, I think the stuff that the church, some of the churches have done, whether it's like Unitarian Universalists or other places of worship, has been phenomenal and great and should totally be supported, even if you're not religious or part of that congregation. Beyond that, things like demonstrations against ICE, like the group Northwest Detention Center Resistance, who it's going down, is interviewed before in the past, and they're doing the current Chingalo Migrator. You know, phenomenal group in the Pacific Northwest. You know, they've done countless demonstrations outside of the detention facility in Tacoma, which actually, interestingly enough, has a history of being protested and organized against and attacked by anarchists in that town for years. But people have been doing demonstrations against that, supporting hunger strikes. I mean, there's a massive amount of actions that happen inside of, you know, detention centers, too. So, I mean, there's a lot of work to be done. I think a lot of it is kind of like below, you know, behind the scenes. And a lot of it's not like sexy flashpoint, like, you know, the police killed somebody and, you know, there was a riot for a week, you know. So a lot of anarchists just aren't, you know, it's not clued in. So you've got to kind of look for it. But I think that definitely, you know, like so many people have developed their skills around anti-fascism, we need to do the same thing around immigration. But there's a lot of things that we can do. There's a lot of stuff to plug into. And again, like I said, like even something like, you know, just going out and passing out Know Your Rights information, like if that's all you can do, at least that's something. You know, but we all need to put work into, you know, fighting against the deportation machine.
Yeah, the only other example I thought of other things to do would be these sort of solidarity networks and groups who are a lot of times not anarchist groups, but organizing against wage theft. That's probably another point of intervention along these lines. Mm-hmm. Well, Matt, we just talked about kind of everything in the United States. Is there anything we missed? Is there any sort of actions and organizing that you think we need to see more of moving forward?
Well, I kind of want to end on, I mean, I think we have kind of like three tasks ahead of us, you know, as people that want a different way of life. I think, you know, first and foremost, you know, a lot of what we've been talking about is exactly what we need to see more of, is building up organs of mass collective self-defense. And that's things like rapid response networks, solidarity networks, tenants associations, you know, anti-fascist organizing the workplace. I mean, we need to increase the capacity of not only ourselves to do that organizing, but moreover of creating spaces and networks of, you know, everyday people to get involved in that, to take those actions. Because the more of that we see, the more people are going to be confident of themselves, the more people we're going to know, and the more base of a support any sort of revolutionary movement is going to have. So the more of that we can do, the better. I think number two is, like we said, in terms of the ecological struggles, is, you know, kind of make the ZAD everywhere. You know, we need to support struggles against the fossil fuel industry. Anything that's putting a dent in, you know, the race to oblivion that, you know, industrial civilization is heading us towards. But moreover, using these you know, areas that people are fighting around, whether it's pipelines or forests, to really grow a sense of, you know, autonomy and resistance and a different way of life. I mean, we need to do that. We need to find out the networks that can support these things in ways that people, even if they're not on the front lines, can engage and support. I think the last thing too is, you know, we kind of talked about this in terms of like resilience projects, but, you know, really bridging living and fighting, building up as much dual power and alternative infrastructure as we can. You know, why aren't we making our own internet service providers? You know, what's stopping us from setting up clinics? How can we become more self-sufficient, but also not do it in a way that, you know, makes us some sort of weird subculture or like a DIY business ghetto, but something that's really connected to resistance struggles. And just, you know, creating more and more space for people to come in. You know, the only other things I would say is, you know, the other big task ahead of us is finding ways to bring as many new people as possible into, you know, our various movements and like creating things that we can do. And I think a lot of, you know, what I just covered is, you know, some basic things, you know, having a community food program, you know, going out and putting up posters and stickers, you know, basic things.
Popular reading groups. Love reading groups.
Reading groups, you know, film showings, you know, creating, you know, a welcoming and fun environment where you can build trust and have friends. I mean, that's what people want. You know, they want something where they can come out, meet other people that are in a similar situation like them, you know, make friends, grow to, you know, have a community of people. You know, that's why people go to church, you know, and building that up. But we physically need more people involved in our movement to do this type of work. You know, the amount of people we have, you know, where we need to go, there's just not enough of us. So we need more people. So in many ways, in some ways, we need to transition from being a very kind of, you know, insular, inward-looking movement into something that's like, you know, actively trying to engage people and bring them in. And I think beyond that, you know, the very last thing is that, you know, like for many years, anarchists have sought to kind of create a crisis in the streets with, whether it's like block party, you know, street parties that get out of control or black blocks and stuff like that. What I'd really like to see is if we began to approach creating a very real political crisis for the state in terms of looking at the way that society is breaking down and trying to, you know, as a movement, as revolutionaries, meet some of these things head on and trying to like do something against them. So for instance, like what's happening in Flint, like what would it mean to take all the infrastructure and all the energy and all the bits, parts and pieces that went into like a mass anti-fascist mobilization? You know, what if we took that and put it into like trying to do something around the crisis in Flint, Michigan? And I think that if we were able to do that, or, you know, anything on that level, try to like look at some of the ways the society is breaking down and actively trying to intervene in that, I think that that would in turn create a real crisis for the state, because it would show that people can again start to meet their own needs on their own terms. And I think that that's something that we should really start to think about, like what that would look like.
Yeah, I mean, I'll tell you what, if anarchists and comrades started building water purification plants in Flint, they'd get those pipes cleaned up real quick. They'd come in real fast with, "Oh, hey, whoa, whoa, we got you, we got you. No more lead. Okay, you win."
Oh, right.
Well, I mean, one thing you were talking about, like bringing people in, and like as someone who worked real hard on trying to create assemblies that were like open and inviting spaces right after Trump was elected, and like we had really big meetings, lots of people coming out, and, you know, culminated in J20 being like the most successful radical shit in Denver in years, and it was cool, you know. But then after that, it was really difficult to keep people, like, you know, a lot of groups saw those meetings, like, all over. It was like, all of a sudden, there's 120 people at the meeting, and then next time there's 70, next time there's 30, next time there's 50, next time it's just you and your three friends who are going down with the ship and a couple strangers who were... And so it's like, I think it would really be worthwhile to have a sort of discussion with a lot of different people about how, like, where these things have failed and how to actually build community, because we would just get a bunch of strangers in a room, be like, what do we want to do? You know, whereas there's probably more intentional things you could do to build trust with that group. And I hate to say it, but I feel like, you know, a lot of times, like in an anarchist space, even if you have an idea, you know, you put that idea forward, you kind of have to be willing to see it through. It's just, I don't know. It definitely makes that shit. It's like, it's just really challenging to keep all those new people around. And because now I feel like a lot of those people have just kind of, like, I still see them around, but it'll be at the Women's March with the clever sign, or, you know, it'll be at the teachers march that's in solidarity, but really it's just another version of the Women's March with selfies.
Right.
It's like, that's the thing I struggle with, is like, how, God, you know.
And it's not like those people are bad for doing that. I mean, they're trying to find something to do, and, you know, they don't have the capacity to, you know, make something happen. And I, you know, so I think, and again, like, you know, not to go off on a tangent on assemblies, but I think, you know, in those moments where something happens and people are brought together, it's important to, you know, again, have actions that come out of that. Like, you know, are we just going to meet forever and it'll eventually run its course and it'll eventually be down to, like, you know, a council amount of people, like 7 people that just meet together and that's all they do is meet? Or are we going to, like, create something out of that that's like a real tangible thing? Yeah, so I think that it's important to experiment and try new things. You know, what can we do? What can we get away with? What do we have the capacity for? You know, what would it mean to organize ourselves in a certain way that meets a certain need? You know, what could we do that creates some sort of, you know, crisis or conflict, you know, with the existing power structure? And sometimes we don't know until we try.
Right. Or until we fail multiple times and then we... You know, but that's how you learn. Right. That's how you learn. Yeah. Well, so, but I feel like in that instant, I feel like in Denver, it's like fucking everybody's joined the DSA and it's just this whitewashed liberal ass shit. I'm wondering what you think are successful ways that radicals have out-organized the institutional left in recent years. Because I feel like under Trump, the biggest... almost the next to the cops, like the biggest challenge is the cops on the left, the Democrats.
Oh, sure. Yeah. And I mean, they're loving this moment because, I mean, the Democrats, because they don't really have to do anything. They just have to be the Democrats because, I mean, literally like there was a, you know, one of the, there was a proposed like Democrat, somebody was running for something and his slogan was, "Have you seen the other guys?" And, yeah, so I mean, that's very real. In terms of ways that, you know, sort of radical or autonomous forces have out-organized the Democrats, I mean, I would say, like, you know, basically pick anything and you'll see how, like, they're out-organized. I mean, obviously, Burgerville is one. You know, a bunch of anarchists and wobblies were able to form the first, you know, recognized fast food workers union in the history. But I think, you know, beyond that, I mean, a big example would be the teacher strikes. I mean, when people got to the point that they were ready to refuse the union leadership, which is essentially refusing the leadership of the Democratic Party, they were suddenly in a position where the state was ready to grant them more and more concessions. And I think that in almost every instance, like, had they gone even farther than they did in all the different strikes, they probably would have got more. They probably would have, like, opened themselves into more open conflict with the state.
I mean, like in some instances, like the National Guard was on standby. But, you know, in all accounts, you know, the more people would have like stopped listening to, you know, the government and the union leadership, the, you know, probably the more leverage they would have had. And I mean, I think that's the history of, you know, class struggle to begin with. But I think people have to remember these things, because a lot of people that are involved in these struggles, they've never experienced anything like this, you know. And if their whole conception of, you know, social change is like, you know, being on Occupy Democrats on Facebook and, you know, voting, then of course they're going to have a very small conception of, you know, what human beings are capable of doing. So, I mean, that's one example. I mean, I'm sure there's lots more, but I mean, those are some clear examples. That's one clear example right there.
Yeah, it's a good one. I mean, there's always the trick of just, you know, getting a couple buddies together behind a black banner and, you know, doing it the other way too. So that's always a way to out-organize the institutional left.
We're planning on having both the Communist Caucus, which is like an anti-state or left communist caucus within DSA, and also the Libertarian Socialist Caucus of DSA. We're planning on doing podcasts with both of those groups, kind of like, why are you in DSA?
That's awesome.
But it'll be interesting, too. I think there's going to be a large split within DSA at some point between people that want to engage in like actual base building movement stuff, or people that want to be like the left wing of the Democrats. Because I know in some cities, like DSA, literally like Democratic hopefuls will go to the DSA chapter and like lobby to be supported by that DSA chapter. So, which, I mean, I don't see how that's necessarily a good thing, you know?
Right. It just means you've been, you're part of the, part of the problem now. Congratulations.
You're literally farming yourself out to, like, you know, get the Democrats elected. You know, and I think that's the other thing, too, that, like, marks our period is that, like, if you look at, like, you know, what's like, the leading voice of, like, the socialist left, like, Jacobin. I mean, their main thing is either creating a left wing within the Democrats or creating, like, a new workers' party. Like, that's, like, literally where they're at, you know? Just like at that base level, you know, which even those goals in themselves, like, are nowhere near, you know, close to, you know, having any, like, you know, chance of being realized. You know, there is no real chance that there's going to be a left wing of the Democratic Party. I mean, the Democrats have, like, made it clear over and over again that it's, you know, moving towards the right and to the center. And also, like, the creation of some sort of, like, third party that's really going to, like, be a contestable, winnable vehicle for change. It's just, I mean, even if it was possible, we just don't have enough time, you know? It's right. It's essentially class war and social movements all the way or nothing.
Or selfies. Lots of selfies.
Right, or just go home, watch Netflix, jerk off, and call it a day.
Yeah, get your God, I wish World of Warcraft was still the heydays of that. Those are some of the best time of my life. All right. How has your thinking on media changed over the years? You've been, you know, involved in a
couple, media in couple. Terms of like our media, or media in terms of like the mass media and our relationship to it?
I guess I mean mediums of communication, you know, from like zines to websites to how things have evolved. But I mean, you can answer the question however it hits you.
Well, it's hard. I mean, like, I think, you know, I remember when podcasts first came out and I was just like, I don't care about podcasts, you know, like, I don't want to do that hipster bullshit. But, you know, now obviously they're a huge part of, you know, how we're, you know, getting the word out and how we're interacting with them. Like, people are making them and they're fun and, you know, I really enjoy them. So, Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, obviously we need, you know, more videos. I think a huge question is, like, how do we get around these? I mean, it's something that we've talked about, but just how do we get around these, like, big platforms like Facebook, which is just, you know, totally, like, throttling and wrecking so much of our shit and, like, you know, causing our hits to go down. You know, how do we, you know, get new audiences and stuff, you know, without, you know, having some sort of, like, large corporation be some sort of gatekeeper? I don't know. It's a huge question, you know, and I don't think we're anywhere near close to having an answer to that. You know, we have lots of ideas, but I mean, we need to continue to experiment and, you know, realize, you know, where we're weak and where we can continue to grow. But I mean, I think obviously for the time being, the internet is still where it's at. You know, I still love print, but, you know, we can put something online and thousands of people will read it. Whereas, you know, we can spend a year fundraising for a paper that, you know, will get old within a couple weeks. So,
yeah, it's crazy.
Which is not to say I'm not in favor of, you know, I'm totally in favor of people doing books and newspapers and stuff like that. And I know that, like, anarchist presses right now are, from what I understand, doing pretty well. You know, I've talked to people at PM and AK, and they seem to be doing pretty well in terms of selling their stuff. So, yeah, I mean, there's a lot to talk about. There's a lot to do. There's a lot to say. You know, let's just get it out there.
Yeah, and, you know, that's one of the things I've always loved about you is you've always, I feel like you have really forward-thinking ideas on this, but also a very, like, I don't know, like, hey, anybody can do this shit. Like, just get out there and fucking start writing about what's happening in your town. And, you know, I just can't imagine what the present moment would be without a platform like It's Going Down. It's, you know, thank you and your crew for all the hard work y'all have done. It's,
thanks.
It's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's all.
Also, I'm glad, like, you're on our side. I'm glad you're on our side.
Well, it's also like everything that people are doing in general that creates the content that goes on IGD, you know, which, you know, if there was like one thing a week that was happening, like, there would be, you know, it wouldn't be that exciting. But the fact that there's like all this stuff, the fact that you can log on and see, like, oh, there's an anti-fascist mobilization, oh, there's a pipeline battle, you know, there's this, there's that, there's this new project. Like, there was just something that came out on IGD the other day that I'm super excited about. People are making a podcast about things that new people can do to get involved in the movement, which I think is, like, totally great. And, I mean, speaks to, like, some of the stuff that we talked about in this interview. But, I mean, you know, that's just awesome that, like, people are, I mean, to me, that's just so cool that people are, like, thinking about things in that way. Like, here's a problem, let's try to address it. Like, let's create something that moves us forward. I mean, that's so, to me, that's so inspiring. You know, that's amazing. And yeah, there's just so much stuff going on that is happening all around us. And that's, you know, largely we've just been talking about, like, in the United States, you know, right. There's stuff happening all across the world.
Because I get people asking me, like, advice sort of questions sometimes. And I think the thing that people would be, I think a lot of people are like, oh, I don't want to, you know, engage with the anarchist milieu because, you know, I won't be smart enough. I'll be attacked. You know, it's a cool kids club kind of shit. And like, the thing that I've always just been really surprised by is just how actually supportive and unimpressive, I mean, not unimpressive, unpretentious, most anarchist groups are, like, almost all of them, all the people, you know what I mean? So many of these people are just kind and like, yeah, let's build, let's keep going, let's keep pushing, as opposed to like, no, we just want this all to ourselves. Like, go vote for Bernie, get the fuck out of here, liberal, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the kind of, like, cocktail party, you know, like, looking down the nose of, you know, at everybody else, era of anarchism, I mean, that's not what we care about. That's not what we're trying to build, you know? We're not out to create some sort of, like, nerdy Model UN where, you know, one side argues about Max Stirner while the other side, like, you know, whines about, you know, the Spanish Civil War. we don't give a shit about that. Like you can go do that on your own time. Like, we don't give a fuck about that. So, you know, there's like real stuff happening. Our lives are at stake, you know. Whether or not, you know, we're going to be able to exist as a human species in the next 50 years is up for grabs. So, I mean, the world's a little bit different than it was, you know, 10 years ago, where, you know, maybe you didn't post something on a website because the comments were going to be mean to you. So, but again, like, you know, again, that, like you said, like, that's, we're trying to create a movement that is inviting to people, that, you know, does allow people the ability to grow. I mean, we post stuff on IGD all the time that, you know, sometimes, you know, is kind of like, wow, this is these people's first thing, you know, like, I don't know. We put up an action report, I think, one time that was like some anarchist kids in some small town, like, got together and like picked up trash, and like that, they did that on Earth Day. It's like, it's kind of like whatever, but at the same time, it's like, whatever, fuck it. Like, you know, if that's your first thing, like, if that's what gets you going, then like, that's fine. But like, let's keep going. And like you said, just keep building. And not that we can't be critical of each other or, you know, have that dialogue, but we're going to do that by having a relationship together, not being snarky assholes to each other.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Okay, so talk about, this is pretty much it. I don't really have, I mean, you know, whatever.
Sure.
I asked you a bunch of shit. So talk about your usage of the term anti-authoritarian, and, you know, if you think it's, like, important to not identify as an anarchist, but sort of the relationship between, like, your thinking around words like anti-authoritarian, like, what it means.
Well, I mean, I think there's been a tension within the United States, which I think has actually been really interesting, of, you know, is what we're trying to do, make people, like, be card-carrying anarchists or sign up to an ideology, or is what we're trying to do instead basically popularize and share a set of practices and, like, tactics and, like, you know, ways that people can organize. Personally, I don't know if those two points are always at tension with each other. Like, you can't do both. And also, like, you know, is the anarchist identity label important? Or, like, instead, should we be more all-encompassing and try to find a word that's maybe not so off-putting to some people, like anti-authoritarian? I mean, personally, I'm up for whatever. You know, to me, it doesn't really matter. And, I mean, you know, what I'm more interested in building is relationships with people across a variety of movements and struggles that have more in common politically and also based on, you know, what they're doing. Because I think, you know, one of the things we've got to realize about this time, like, if polls are to be believed, you know, if you could take everybody's political position and make it real and put everybody in America into the bodies of four people, two of those people would largely be like, I don't like Trump. Things are shitty. Things are getting worse. One of those people of the four would be like gung-ho Donald Trump. And the other one would be like a centrist, basically. Like, you know, I don't know about Trump, but, you know, we've got to save America or something. So that means that there's a huge, vast majority of people in the United States that don't like the political system, have no faith in the current political corporate parties, largely don't vote, you know, have no stake within the current system, largely think it's unfair, think that, you know, the rich are getting richer and the poor are getting poorer, things are getting worse, you know, because they are, you know, just basically everyday working class people that have no faith in the system. So what that means is that the vast majority of people that are out there really are not like these, you know, progressives necessarily that we have to like win over, or even these like, you know, quasi fascist and waiting Trump supporters. The vast majority of people are people that are pretty open to a message of like, hey, like the established system and the way that it runs things is fucked. and that, you know, there could be a better way of not only living our lives but changing things that doesn't involve any of this bullshit, you know. And I think that that's what we need to realize. And you know, those people are up for grabs. Those people are who we should be speaking to. And I think what, you know, what I've seen that people get excited about is when people do things, you know, they do things that really speak to their everyday experiences. You know, people, you know, saw this problem and they did something about it, you know, outside of the rules, you know, against the police, you know, for their own interests. Like, that's what people get excited about, you know, and that's why people, you know, get excited about anti-fascism. You know, people punch Richard Spencer. Like, that's cool. It's funny, you know. People took over this. People squatted this space and started a garden. People went on rent strike. You know, it's out of the ordinary. It's illegal. It's it speaks to what people wish they had the ability to do if they had enough friends and, you know, enough confidence, you know. And that's what people get excited about. And if at the end of the day, if people understand that to be anarchism, then that's great. But is that necessarily how we're going to win? I don't think so. I mean, I don't think that that label per se is what's important. I mean, if you look back in history, and again, like, if you look at, like, Spain in, you know, leading up to the 1930s, I mean, you know, millions of people involved in the anarchist movement, by and large, were most of those people, like, you know, people that had sat down and read Kropotkin and, like, you know, read through all of the ideological stuff. No, not necessarily. But they were part of the anarchist movement in the sense that they supported the actions that the movement engaged in. And also they realized, moreover, that they benefited from that movement doing those things. And they saw themselves as a part of it. And that's really what's important.
Yeah, totally, totally. I mean, because I've even, you know, you hear, like, whatever, Democrat union type dudes who be like, oh, I love the Wobblies, you know.
Yeah.
Right on. Well, so, you know,
and I mean, just you know, one last thing. I mean, like, if you think at, like, the anarchist groups and networks, you know, over the period of the course of decades in America that have had huge impact in the industrial workers of the world, you know, hundreds of thousands of members, like, last a huge impression, like you said, on the culture, you know, was not capital A anarchist, but it popularized, you know, this idea of a general strike, of a world without a government run by the workers, you know, against, you know, abolish the wage system, you know, a world without money. But also, like, promoting sabotage, and, you know, it, you know, took up guns and fought the Klan.
Solidarity across borders.
Yeah, solidarity. And, you know, Earth First. I mean, literally, like, you know, stopped massive amounts of logging. I mean, there's forests you can go to because Earth First took action. You know, it had a huge impact. You know, anti-racist action. You know, like, on, we had a recent podcast that talked about the history of anti-racist action, like, hundreds of chapters across the United States had a mailing list of 33,000 people, you know, a degree in which, you know, today would seem like almost unimaginable. But I mean, this is like in the 80s and 90s before the internet. And, like, you know, at that time, smashed out of existence, you know, the neo-Nazi movement up until, you know, when the alt-right came around. And again, like, had a huge, huge impact, you know, went on tour with Wu-Tang Clan, you know, all this type of stuff. So, and again, like, these are not because somebody was, you know, passing out Noam Chomsky, what is anarchism, per se. It's about people engaging with other human beings and doing things together, and people seeing an outcome of that, and their lives getting better in the process.
Yeah, for real. And yeah, and of course, you know, we could list off a million other recent things where, you know, whether it's Standing Rock or Ferguson, like, direct action gets the motherfucking goods every day of the week.
Right.
So it's going down. How long has this going down been around? 4 years or something?
Well, this month in June Three. Will be our third year, yeah.
So, you know, it's a fucking tightly... you're putting out a lot of work for a tiny skeleton crew of folks. You know, for a while, y'all had built up a decent following on Patreon, and we're getting a pretty big... check every month, and then y'all got targeted. And
we had like $1,200. It wasn't that big, but
I mean, I don't know. I'd like to have. I mean, it's nice to have an extra $1,200 every month. You know, how can people support you financially to help IGD grow in this period?
Well, right now we're in the process of rolling out kind of a new fundraiser. So we were kicked off of Patreon. But so we're in the process right now of kind of rolling out like a 3-year, you know, yay for IGD, and also another call for funds. We're going to go instead of before what we did is we asked for about, you know, a monthly goal, which for like a year we met and people have been really grateful. And I think last year after we were kicked off of Patreon, we kind of stopped asking for money so much because people just kind of like helped us out and we were able to kind of survive. But at this point we need to go back to having a monthly goal and really sustaining ourselves. But instead of asking for every month, we're going to have a end of the year goal, which is $20,000, which is about what we were asking for before, which is about $2,500 a month until the end of the year. So we're going to have a goal of, you know, raising $20,000 by the end of the year, and we're asking people to pitch in. The easiest thing people can do is to go to our site, go to itsgoingdown.org/shop. It's one of the options up at the top. If you can become a monthly sustainer, you know, $10 or $20 will really go far. If we had, you know, 200 people giving us $20 a month, you know, we'd be set. More than that, we'd be able to expand what we're doing. I think beyond asking for money, though, you know, one of the things that I would say right now is that some of the people that have written columns over the course of the site's life have, like, gone on to do other things. So it'd be great if people wanted to step up and, you know, add their voice to It's Going Down. Like, if you've been thinking about, you know, I really want to write a column, like, even if you had something come out, like, once a month, you know, now's the time. Like, we'd really love to hear from people, no matter what kind of thing you want to talk about or where you're coming from. It would be great. So if you want to be on a platform where a lot of people are going to see it and you want to be on IGD, please reach out to us, info@itsgoingdown.org. One of the most recent columns that we've had roll out is something called Vandalisms, which is graffiti and street art column, and it's been very popular. So we'd like to get some new people to sign up to do some crazy shit.
So just tell them to have a column. Pitch you ideas and just write some shit.
Yeah, I mean, we're very open. We usually don't say no. So if you have an idea, something you want to work on, you know, literally, like, you know, minimum once a month, if you can submit a column, that would be awesome. You know, or if you wanted to do like a podcast and just basically put the IGD stamp on it, as long as you're down to put in the work, we're down to share it kind of like under the IGD umbrella, as long as it, you know, fits into what we're doing.
Fuck, but, I should just rename my podcast to the IGD cast then.
Sure. then I would stop doing. I would stop doing it so much, and we just, you know, trade off.
Oh, but, great, that's great.
But yeah, the sky's the limit. So, you know, get a hold of us if you're looking for a platform to do something on. Also, if you for some reason have the desire to repost articles and stare at a screen for hours a day, and you want to do that for some strange reason, get a hold of us. We do need people to help out, you know, repost stuff from other websites. That's a big part of what we do. But yeah, if you want to put in that work, get at us.
Awesome. Any last words?
No, I mean, it's an exciting time. Let's keep building. You know, let's look to what seems impossible right now. You know, what would it mean to go beyond where we are? Because a couple years ago, where we're at right now, you know, would seem impossible. But let's continue to push. Let's continue to grow. You know, let's keep talking together. Let's keep building up our regional networks and capacity. You know, let's keep reaching across group lines and talking to each other. And let's continue to support each other.
It's going down, and you're invited for what they're selling. We ain't buying. There is no running. There is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they're selling. We ain't buying. There is no running. There is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. While they howl at the moon, blue lights howl back. There's a chip in my pocket and I know how to use it. While I sit in the plot, all I want is a new roof. They want jobs, I want time, they want God, I want proof. I want my wife to be home, not at work. Let's chill, let's read, but get done, cause we take them to the streets. Probably not, my city's so divided. They want a whitewash Martin and misquote a cider. Come on, let's be real, let's be air, not be gold. Let's bend, not be broken, let's build, not be soul. Let's take it to their homes where they sell us all out. They want to buy up the block, kick everybody out. Charge for the pipes that they didn't even build. They charge for the streets with police waiting tow. Who is the city for? We shop some real tours. Car notes to the moon while they gas up the prairie dog. The state of every city is a flood. When I first moved here, it was cheap and had meth heads. Now it's just tech bros and paleo coffee shops. Progress escapes us, can't help but hate us. Thinking I'm white trash, it's the bike, not a Prius. All of these weed stores are owned by rich white boys. While black folks who sold weed sitting in jail cells. It's depressing, but that's the way they want it, not us. Let's be honest, they turn fear into commas. Then they turn the Animas River into Hades. Fuck around and poisoned every rest from here to Phoenix. Speaking of settlers, I got 20 on a vegan pizza. You'll make me nostalgic for 90 era hipsters. I don't wanna make a living, I'm here to keep a promise. Finally get set, leave it better than you found it. That's a tall order, no world order. Only oil oligarchs and hot fructose corn syrup soda. They burn the food stamps, downtown is a boot camp. If you want a class war, I'll be an insurgent. All life in the fast lane, it to us is abstract. In the gas mask. Fate of every city is a flood. The fate of every city is a flood. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running. There is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running. There is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying. It's going down, and you're invited for what they selling. We ain't buying. There is no running. There is no hiding. There's only fighting or dying.